Language and compiler design are fundamental aspects of computer science. High-level languages are how most developers interact with computers, so it's hard to overstate the significance of compiler engineering or the aesthetics of language syntax. C# is a general-purpose high-level language that was created by Anders Hellberg at Microsoft in 2000 and was open-sourced in 2014. Jared Parsons is the principal developer lead on the C# language team at Microsoft, where he's worked for 20 years. He joins the show to talk about how the C# compiler is developed, the compiler as an API, language creation as an art, the experience of open sourcing C#, and much more. This episode of Software Engineering Daily is hosted by Sean Falconer. Check the show notes for more information on Sean's work and where to find him.
Jared, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining. Let's start with some basics. Who are you? What do you do?
So my name is Jared Parsons. I'm the C# compiler lead and a member of the C# language design team. And so I work at Microsoft.
Awesome. And then you've been at Microsoft for quite some time. How long has it been?
About a week ago, it became 20 years.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
It was really hard sending out the email for my 20 year. I had to find a photo when I started, and turns out there weren't many digital cameras 20 years ago, so I had to look really hard for one. Mm-hmm.
Did you go directly from school to Microsoft? Was that the path?
Yeah, I had interned over the summer, and then I graduated and just came straight to Microsoft afterwards.
Awesome. Yeah, so C# was actually, it first came out when I was doing my undergrad in computer science. And at school, I mostly programmed in Java and C++ back then. But whenever I was working as an engineer for companies like locally on internships and stuff like that, they were all Microsoft shops, but it was all ASP, Visual Basic stuff back then. So when C# first got announced, I was like really excited because at the time it felt like a much better design version of Java. And then it was also a giant leap forward in terms of like where we were with web languages around ASP and Visual Basic. And it's probably the only language I've ever read the actual like technical spec for, and even did my programming languages project focused on C#. Now, of course, that was all like 20 years ago when you were just, you know, starting at Microsoft. And I haven't really done that much work in it outside of sort of the first 5 years of existence. So I kind of want to go back and look at some of that beginning, some of your history there. What was the motivation for Microsoft to first like invest in C#, and then why continue to invest in it?
Yeah, so the initial investment predates me. I actually started as an undergrad using C# too, and then ended up moving into Microsoft and the .NET team a few years later. But I know like a lot of our initial kind of reason for doing it is if you kind of go back in time to when C# was invented, Microsoft primarily had two languages, Visual Basic, which was very much on one extreme of languages, and C++. And there was no kind of middle ground for like, how do I build business applications that can be a little more low level, that can work across all these different versions of Windows, be easily deployable. And C# really kind of filled that void for them. And so very much in the beginning, it was a web and line of business type of language. Mm-hmm. As for why we continue investing in it, I mean, for a long time, it was a very successful line of business application. Most Microsoft GUIs from that time going forward, like Visual Studio, they're all very much like C# .NET based languages. These days, though, one of the reasons we invested in them a lot is like, frankly, just like performance. So with the kind of shift away from .NET framework and putting a lot of our emphasis on .NET Core, which is a much more Xcopy deployable, you can have multiple deployments on the machine type of framework, it allowed us to invest a lot more in performance. Because one of the big problems we had with .NET framework was the burden of breaking changes. Turns out, if you have a framework that is shipped on 4 billion devices, roundabouts, and any change you make to it and immediately ship it to 4 billion machines, the breaking changes get noticed by someone and they're bad. And it really inhibits your innovation. When we move to .NET Core, and we could let the customers control their deployment. When do I move to a new version of .NET or C#? They can absorb breaking changes a little bit better, and we can start investing in things like performance. A lot of Microsoft services today, even within Azure, are written in C#. And as pretty much with every release of .NET now, as we move forward, we can really focus a lot on performance and reduce those COGS costs for those services. That can have massive multiplier effects for the company, where it's just like, in November, we release a new version of .NET. A lot of services get cheaper to run for us and for our customers.
In terms of the breaking changes, how does that sort of like hinder the development of a language?
Yeah, so there's breaking changes on a couple levels. There's both kind of the how .NET does breaking changes when the runtime, how do the libraries do it, how do they change little semantics within performance, stuff like that. But in terms of language, which is where I'm more centered, breaking changes is a very big deal. One of the, like, one of the things I drive home for the compiler team, it's very much one of my mottos, is the number one feature of C# is compatibility. It's like, we very much want the experience of, you are not afraid to move the new version of .NET. You're not afraid to buy a new version of Visual Studio because you know your code's going to keep compiling. We will not break you. We will make sure that unless you have done something absolutely extreme, like it's just going to work. And that is indeed our number one feature. At the same time, though, that does push an enormous burden on us. And it's something that when we're in language design, we spend an enormous amount of time thinking about. It's like, how can we design these new features which go in and solve all these other problems that do not disrupt our existing ecosystem? And it is, we have both an enormous amount of discipline in like how we design, how we test, how we preview, and how we ship to make sure that we kind of keep that mentality.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about like in the API world, like obviously any breaking change there is a big deal, especially if you have it's a widely used API. Essentially, you're like signing a contract in many ways about how this thing's going to work. And languages are like the ultimate contract, because if suddenly a function that I called that's like core to whatever it is I built like works substantially different or goes away, then it's hard to like know what's going on there, but it's also completely detrimental to the product that I've built. And there's also a new learning curve that will be experienced by the organization to learn whatever those kind of changes that were made that are no longer backwards compatible.
Yeah, it is very much a big problem. And the good thing, though, is these days we actually have a few tools to help us out. If you shift back like 10 years in how .NET worked, whenever you got a new version of .NET, everything was latest. Like you get the latest version of .NET, you get the latest version of language. And that meant the breaking change bar, like there was no lever for us. It's like any decision we make to change behavior affects everyone when they move forward. About 7-ish years ago, with kind of the movement .NET SDK, what we did was C# has always internally understood what version of the language it's operating on. It has a version tick under the hood. And what we did is, whenever you move, kind of the way you move forward in .NET is you say, hey, I want to move from like .NET 2 to .NET 3 to .NET 5 and so forth. Under the hood, we just move the language version along with that new version of .NET. And that's very different from Git. Like you might get a new version of our product or a new version of our SDK. That changes nothing. When you go into your code and you're like, hey, it's time for me to move to the new version .NET. I want to switch something in my code. Under the hood, we move that language version forward. It just kind of ticks with the version of .NET. Mm-hmm. And that has been an enormous lever for us to basically say, okay, we found a particular behavior, how switch expressions work. A very good example is in .NET 7, we changed very much how lambdas, type inference around lambdas, and overload resolution around lambdas. That is an enormous breaking change in terms of how very corner cases of overload resolution work. We knew that would break customers. Like there was no doubt. It's like, we're going to make some changes. A lot of things are going to get better. We're going to break some people. But because we had this lever at our disposal now, we just said, these new rules don't take effect until you're on .NET 7 or higher. Mm-hmm. And so that let us have an experience where we could do these breaking changes that were overall good and move the product, language, and ecosystem forward, but didn't impact any of our existing customers until they chose to take the journey with us. And then we had a lot of guides for like, if you're one of the people who hit one of these corners, like here's how you kind of get yourself out of that corner. But it kept that model we want of don't be afraid to get a new SDK. Don't be afraid to get a new Visual Studio. The code's going to keep working. The breaks we introduce will happen when you move forward to .NET. And there's a lot of emphasis around that and help to get customers over that hump. Mm-hmm.
Let's face it, no one likes writing or maintaining documentation. But when you start a technical project or pick up a new task, missing information can cost you valuable time. Gitbook is a technical knowledge platform that fills that information gap, making it easy for your team to capture, maintain, and find information from a single source of truth. Here's a couple of examples. With GitSync, you can set up a two-way sync between your repo and Gitbook, so you can turn markdown files into awesome, user-friendly docs. And if you make a change in your codebase or a technical writer updates updates the docs in Gitbook, the edits sync between the two automatically. Or what about when you need to find something in your knowledge base? Forget about searching, just ask Gitbook AI. You'll get a neat summarized answer sourced directly from your docs. Those are just a few examples of what Gitbook can do, but it has plenty more tricks up its sleeve. So why not give it a try? Head to gitbook.com to find out more.
What's the cost, though, to the team at Microsoft to, one, like, I imagine there's like a certain amount of bloat that comes with trying to maintain backwards compatibility or maintain older code that's there for certain versions of the language. But also, how does bug fixes work? Like, if there's a bug with an older version that doesn't exist in the newer version, is that something that you actually spend time fixing, or essentially the workaround for somebody is like, they'll just need to progress with the language?
Most of the time, we do bug fixes that affect all versions of the language. Like, people come to us and say, I have a bug. And we're like, yep, that goes all the way back to here, and we'll fix it. Ideally, what we try to do is, for most bug fixes, thankfully, a lot of it is my code doesn't compile. Fixing my code doesn't compile is, except in extreme cases, not a real meaningful compat change to your customers. So fixing those, there's no fear of those. It's like, okay, yeah, this didn't use to compile. You're right. We have a spec violation. Let's go fix that. What becomes more devious is when you find bugs for code that does compile, but compiles incorrectly. And then we have to make a very conscious decision of, do we make this change and then affect anyone who's using the compiler? Or do we say, we want to tie this change to a new version of the language? You must actually move forward to a new version of .NET before you see this bug fix. And a lot of that just really comes down to experience and gut feelings on, we look at the scenario and we say, how likely do we think it is that certain how many customers are going to hit this? Like, if it's a very, very tiny amount, just make it the blanket change and move forward. If we're like, that's a pretty big scenario, we know a lot of customers hit that, then we're much more likely to say, let's tie that behavior to a new version language. Mm-hmm. And that does introduce like costs. Like, we do have an enormous amount of test code, which is just what happens when you compile this code with this version language and that version language. It's very common in our code, if you're familiar with XUnit, to see theories in our code where it's like, same code, this version language, that version language, like, what does it do? That's very common in our code base to see that. And compat is an enormous burden. Like I say, we go through very big links to make sure we do it. Like, one of my favorites is, depends on the day, but between 4 to 8 times a day, we change the C# compiler that builds Visual Studio, and we rebuild the entire product. And so it's basically, as we merge pull requests into GitHub, within about 4 hours, we've produced a new compiler. And then about 8 hours later, that compiler has built Visual Studio. And that is an enormous code base that has been developed over the entire lifetime of C#. And it has just a beautiful set of different styles and different eras of C# that we can like then run our new compiler against. And one of my jokes is, you haven't actually become a member of the C# compiler team until your code can get all the way through our rigorous GitHub pull request, but then break the Visual Studio build. It's like, that's when you've arrived and you've become like a real member of our team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know you're having impact when you break stuff, right?
Yeah. It's like, okay, wow. It's like, this is a learning opportunity for all of us.
Yeah.
This episode of Software Engineering Daily is brought to you by Vantage. Do you know what your cloud bill will be for this month? For many companies, cloud costs are the number 2 line item in their budget and the number 1 fastest growing category of spend. Vantage helps you get a handle on your cloud bills with self-serve reports and dashboards built for engineers, finance, and operations teams. With Vantage, you can put costs in the hands of the service owners and managers who generate them, giving them budgets, alerts, anomaly detection, and granular visibility into every dollar. With native billing integrations with dozens of cloud services, including AWS, Azure, GCP, Datadog, Snowflake, and Kubernetes, Vantage is the one FinOps platform to monitor and reduce all your cloud bills. To get started, head to vantage.sh, connect your accounts, and get a free savings estimate as part of a 14-day free trial.
So some of these products at Microsoft that are using C Sharp is essentially the language of choice. Like, how are those decisions made when there's like a net new project, a new software project? Like, how is the language choice actually, what's that decision-making process?
Oh man. So I work in DevDiff, and so that's very much the developer tools section of Microsoft. And we have a huge investment in .NET. So pretty much when we do new tools, unless you're on like the C++ team, it's pretty much going to be C Sharp or .NET based language. Outside of DevDiv, I think the way it's approached is there's a number of languages which are kind of like approved for new projects at Microsoft. It's like, if you want to do C Sharp, that's fine. These days, Rust, Go, things like that. Like, we have a number of languages or Python where it's okay, these are the boundaries they fall in. But I think most of it comes down to just what organization are you part of? What is their big investment in? Because especially in the big organizations, it's not little single tiny projects. It is a collection of teams working for like bigger goals. And there's all kinds of existing libraries, services, and stuff to build on. And so most likely, I expect most teams end up following kind of the suit for where they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As a listener of Software Engineering Daily, you understand the impact of generative AI. On the podcast, we've covered many exciting aspects of Gen AI technologies, as well as the new vulnerabilities and risks they bring. HackerOne's AI Red Teaming addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses launching new AI deployments. Their approach involves stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. Within the HackerOne community, over 750 active hackers specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and safety testing. In a single recent engagement, a team of 18 HackerOne hackers quickly identified 26 valid findings within the initial 24 hours and accumulated over 100 valid findings in the two-week engagement. HackerOne offers strategic flexibility, rapid deployment, and a hybrid talent strategy. Learn more at hackerone.com/AI. That's HackerOne.com/AI.
And then going back to the actual compiler, can you walk me through like the phases of the compilation process? Like, what does it actually look like to compile something in C Sharp?
Sure. So the way the compiler works today is actually if you run like most people's entry point to the actual command line compiler is MS Build. So you either run MS Build, .NET Build, or you build from Visual Studio. Build is actually, I often tell people, is build is a complicated process of which like the compiler is like this little tiny piece. We take source files and references. But under the hood, we actually have a server that we start when you start a build, which we let every essentially compilation event go into kind of this compiler server that we run in the background and handles all the requests. We do that for a lot of performance reasons. But the phases of the compiler are probably like not too surprising for anyone who's like taken a basic compilers class. We have our initial parsing phases, we get our parsing trees, we then kind of build up our initial semantic model where we go through all of your top level symbols. Like, let's bind the classes, their kind of base types, look at all the method signatures, let's make sure we can assign that these are all real names, we have symbols for them. And all of that stuff is actually done in parallel. So we do like all of our parsing, for instance, like we just basically parallel parse every file in your code base. Then we start running through initial binding, getting those decal trees. And then we do what's called compiling method bodies, just going method by method, evaluating the syntax, binding, and emitting the IL. In many ways, it's not too different than anything you would expect. What I think is really interesting about our compiler is we kind of think of the batch compiler as a secondary feature. The C-sharp compiler is very much developed as a library. So if you go and pull apart the actual csc.exe, it's about 1,000 lines of code. It's not that much. And all it is basically grabbing arguments and calling into our library. And that library, if you look at it, we have a full fidelity syntax tree. Like, you can ask the library to parse a file, you'll get back a beautiful syntax tree that if you take that syntax tree and two-string it, you'll get like byte for byte identical strings that you initially parsed, and we're very rigorous about that. You will have what we call a semantic model, where you can basically say like, hey, I have this node in the tree. Can you tell me what symbol that is? Can you take that name string and give me a symbol and let me see if that's the string for .NET or some other serialization artifact over here? And that API is very much used by things like Visual Studio. the entire Visual Studio experience is built on top of the compiler as an API. And that is very much like the most interesting part of our compiler. And from that perspective, it doesn't really have phases. Like, yes, we understand the IDE is largely going to do parsing on top of us, but then they're going to grab random semantic models and start asking questions because they have to do things like colorize files. They need to know what type of token this is, what category it is. They want to know, hey, is that thing a class? Is it a struct? And they ask us all kinds of questions. When they're generating IntelliSense, they want to say like, hey, what are the members for this symbol so I can generate an IntelliSense list? And so strangely, it's like our first job is actually thinking of ourselves as a library and thinking really like, how can we help the IDE team build like a very fluent and beautiful experience for C Sharp? Mm-hmm. The batch compiler is in some ways kind of boring. It's very little code. We don't touch it as much after we write the IL. We spend a significant more time talking with the IDE team about like, how can we make our APIs expressive enough that you can build all the cool things you want to build in Visual Studio, VS Code, and also just there are all kinds of other tools around Microsoft where people host the compiler and they basically use it to run in like all kinds of little sub-tools and analysis. Lastly, the compiler is also a plugin system these days. We allow customers to insert two types of plugins into the compiler. The first one is what we call like an analyzer. So very often people have domain-specific rules for their code. Like if you have your own serialization framework, you will probably have rules about like what types are allowed to be serialized, what type of constructors you might have, what type of members you cannot have if you're going to be serialized. Those are errors we're never going to put in the C# compiler. We're not adding diagnostics for your custom framework. But via analyzers, you can add your own warnings. And an analyzer is a plugin that goes in the compiler. As we're compiling, we start throwing symbols at these analyzers saying like, here's a new class, here's a new member. And those plugins can then start generating domain-specific warnings about that. Like we have a lot of different tools out there which have these plugins. Like XUnit has a plugin, an analyzer, which will tell you when you've done your facts incorrectly, when you've done theories incorrectly. It'll help point out all these little bugs in your code. And so that is a very powerful tool that people have taken an enormous advantage of. And lastly, the other thing we added about three releases ago was a very similar model where we allow people to generate code as a plugin to the compiler. And this is something that libraries very commonly do now, is libraries will have a generator paired with them that plugs into the compiler and will ahead of time generate code that supports their library. A really good example of this is like regexes in .NET. So regexes, typically you write like you new up a regex object, you pass in a string, and at runtime, the regex has to parse it, it has to generate all the CFGs and all the models under the hood, and it has to do this very quickly and produce code that will then match those things very quickly. Well, with the power with source generators now, what we actually do is just run that code at compile time. So you basically define a method, you mark it as let the regex generator run here, and you put your regex string on there. And at compile time, the author of the regex library has a generator that looks at the string, parses it out, and generates all the code at compile time, adds it into your program, and then like at runtime, all that code, it's gone away. When you match a regex, it's just straight into the code for matching a regex. And it's an enormous performance boost for items like
definitely.
That.
So you talked about this design choice around making sort of the compiler more like an API, essentially, and the impact that has around Visual Studio. So was that design choice primarily essentially influenced when that first came about by the relationship between Visual Studio and the compiler and trying to make like a great dev experience?
100%. So if you go back in time, the compiler you use today for C# is written in C# and generally referred to as Roslyn. The original compiler was written in C++. And it was very much, if you looked at how Visual Studio was constructed, we had a compiler team and they went off and built the compiler. And we had an IDE team that went off and built the Visual Studio experience. And this was possible to have these two separate teams that each of them kind of had their own parser. They all each had their separate binders and a couple of things. And for C#1.0, that was fine. C#1.0 was a very simple language, comparatively speaking. It's just classes, properties, methods, a little bit of load resolution logic. Two teams could write their own little binders, no problem. Well, in C#2, you got generics. That means you get type inference. Things get a little bit harder now. and the IDE team's having to write more and more code. Well, then around C-Sharp 3, we get Link. So language integrated queries. That is a very expensive, like a very computationally expensive process. It's very hard to write all the binding rules for Link. And this is where the IDE team started to get a bit of a breaking point. Like, hey, we can't keep up with you all. Like, we have to both replicate all the craziness you all are doing in the language and build a beautiful experience around it. And you can see at the time, the code bases started to merge. They started to like share a parser. They started to share a lot of the binding operations. And they started kind of trying to get closer and closer to this one code base. And that was kind of how things went along for about the 7 to 10 years. But the problem is, you end up having, like, you were trying to retrofit this compiler, which was a batch compiler, had very specific memory allocation patterns that are just like, hey, let's batch compile as fast as possible. And then you had this IDE team, which is like, hey, we exist in Visual Studio. Objects are very long-lived. And also at the same time, Visual Studio was moving from a tool that was written in C++ to one that is very much written in C#. Like, we had introduced WPF as the kind of main UI for Visual Studio. And so you have the IDE team getting dragged in the other direction between like, hey, we're getting pushed to more and more managed code, more C#, but our kind of engine is this like C++ code base that was really never designed to be called this way. Mm-hmm. And so you had this big tension within our own team. But then also when you looked around Microsoft, we found the exact same tension. There are many people around Microsoft who are like, we want to analyze our C#, and we want to do things with it. We want to format it. We want to look at it for bugs. Probably the most famous tool for this was StyleCop. StyleCop was not a person who came by and used a C# compiler. They couldn't. There was a C++ code base that was not rehostable. They rewrote basically a C# parser and analysis engine in C#. And that was not unique. We found, I think, something like 10 to 20 different C# parsers and binders in the company, of varying degrees of accuracy. And so there was a tipping point that kind of got hit around the Visual Studio 2010 release and a little bit before that, where Visual Studio had gone so far into managed code and so far into C#, the C# language was having problems keeping up with Visual Studio and getting the experiences we wanted out of it. And that's when they kind of said, it's time to rethink how we're approaching this problem. Mm-hmm. We need to think about compilers as a service to the IDE, to the batch compiler. We want to rethink this, and we want to kind of restart this process. And that's when a portion of the team forked off for a number of years to kind of re-engineer the compiler as a library approach, and then rebuild our IDE services and batch services on top of it. It was a pretty big bet back then, and it took about 5 to 6 years to come to fruition, but it was definitely very much an inflection point in the development of the language.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense that you'd end up with sort of this siloed parsers all over the place, because there's lots of places in different types of products like dev tools and stuff like that where it's valuable to be able to like parse the language or show some representation of the language or even do something like IntelliJ as part of the dev tool, that then you end up basically recreating certain parts of the parser. So like the design choice makes a ton of sense. Like I can really see why you essentially moved in that direction. And actually, a project I worked on when I was in graduate school was this project called Tagsy. And I tried to build it into Visual Studio, where the idea was, it was kind of like a new take on commenting and also being able to jump through code where you would like tag different parts of the code. You could like tag something as a bug and have some sort of reference in it and stuff like that. And we would have to parse the code essentially to build this tag hierarchy structure and stuff like that as a plugin. And it was a lot of work to try to do it in Visual Studio with C# at the time, because we end up basically having to resolve that problem of like, how do we actually parse the code and get something intelligent and pull out the pieces that we need. And it would have been great to basically hit an API endpoint to do most of the work for us.
Yeah, and that's something we see like over and over and over again. And what's really cool is we initially designed this for like, hey, we want to make Visual Studio great, help ourselves. And there's some internal teams that we know are trying to do these things. But to see like the things people have built on top of it that we just, it's like when you put an API out there and it's nice, like what do people build on top of it? We ended up like, there's this tool called sharplab.io, which is a web browser that where you can just start typing C#, and it will compile it for you. It will show you the IL. It will show you the parse trees. It will show you, it'll even let you like run code. It's like, we didn't build this. This very nice guy, Ashmine, built this. And it's like, it's one of these things where they built it and it's now one of the most important tools for the C-sharp compiler team. Like we're in C-sharp language design using this tool that someone built on top of our APIs. Like we're like, hey, wait a minute, how does that rule work in overload resolution? Like what's the, and we just like go sharp lab it and like put it up in language design and like start showing it. So it's really interesting to see like all the different things people have built once mm-hmm. we kind of give them the tools to build it.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. What's the process of implementing a new feature in the compiler and how is that different maybe than implementing a feature in sort of like a classic application that's maybe like a SaaS app or a, you know, consumer application or something like that?
So the actual process, the way we approach this is we do pretty much all of our features in a feature branch. So we just throw a new branch up on GitHub and we start working in there. And our process is very much like our standard dev process. We've tried different couple things over the years, but what we have found works best for us is we follow the exact same rules for building a feature that we follow for building a bug fix. Every change you make into a feature is going to have two people sign off on it. You're going to be passing all of the tests. The only kind of leeway we give to feature development is we acknowledge that you can't do a feature in a PR. You have to break them up to discrete commits. And so we have this like very specific formats for comments. We call it like a prototype comment. Like, I didn't solve generics, I'll come back here later. We allow those type of things because we found it was too burdensome to file issues for like the hundreds of things we know we have to fix in the feature. But outside of that, we spent a lot of time getting the compiler online, getting our APIs in order. And as we're kind of getting to the end of that, we actually start bringing in the C-sharp IDE team. Because one thing about C-sharp, and this is something I believe about all languages, is languages that just have compilers are toys. Languages are defined by the ecosystem of tools that support them. If we come out with a feature in C-sharp that doesn't work in Visual Studio, we will get zero feedback. No one is going to help us understand if we've done the right things or the wrong things. So when we ship a feature, we try to ship the experience. And so as we get far enough in our feature branch that we're kind of done with a feature, we bring in the IDE team. They help us round out the corners. We make sure the base experience is in place. Maybe not all the bells and whistles, maybe not new refactorings, new code fixes, but you can use this feature in Visual Studio. We then kind of put it back into main, and then we basically start moving it through the Visual Studio preview process. Customers will get a new Visual Studio preview. If you ever want to try out a new C-sharp feature, you just go and set your language version to preview, and suddenly it'll just start lighting up in Visual Studio. You don't have to do any new installs, no side packages. It's just right there for you to play with. And that's kind of the basic process by which we ship the feature, because it'll stay in preview from anywhere from 9 months to a month to 9 months, depending on when the annual cycle we ship something. And then as we move to a new version of .NET, which usually ships around November, we will graduate features out of preview and they'll just become a part of the experience. In terms of how it differs from other kind of features and shipping, I think a lot of it is just that C-sharp impacts all C-sharp developers. Like when we change the compiler, we're not impacting the subset of customers who use our product. The subset of our customers is like all C-sharp developers. And so our impact can be huge. And so we are very deliberate with the order in which we ship features. Like some features we go into and we're like, we know what the answers are for this feature. Like this feature is just about us committing to get the work done. And for those features, like quality is our only concern. We have a lot of processes by which we feel pretty good about quality. Customers will always surprise us and give us strange things, but we feel good about that. We have other features for which we go into them and we're like, we think we know what we're doing. We think we know what the right answer to this is, but we always find these inflection points in features as be like, it depends on if more customers have thought like left or right about this problem. And so features like that, we are very deliberate in that we try to ship them very early in the release because we want to give people as much time as possible. Play with them, give us feedback, tell us if we made the right left and right decisions here so that we can adjust course before we actually hit RTM, fix them. And the other problem, which might be different from other things, is when we ship something, we're going to be maintaining that forever. Like these are forever decisions. And that is daunting at times. We do have some leeway. Like when we ship a feature, I often tell customers, for the first six months, I can change anything I want. I can break changes. Like there are bugs. They're just, oh, we made a slight design decision here. We're going to fix that. But once you get to like a features man in the wild for like 9 months to a year, at some point it becomes permanent. And so it is a very daunting thing to think about when we ship, like, did we make the right decision? Because we have to maintain this forever.
Mm-hmm. And what about the actual release cycles and how has that changed over time?
So when I first started at Microsoft, our release cycles were somewhere between 2 to 5 years. depending on which product cycle you're on, like where you were, there were some longer releases and shorter releases. And I remember back then when we go into release, when you get into that like ship date, like, and we also had not a lot of update mechanisms. It's like you have security updates and like reliability updates only, like no feature patches in the middle. So when you're getting to like kind of that ship or no ship decision, and you're like, my God, like if I can't convince my manager to ship my feature, customers might not see it for 4 years. The intensity in those discussions would be quite high because this is like real things. As we move to kind of .NET Core model now, though, like as things have gotten better and better over time, but now with .NET Core, we ship annually. So we ship like an RTM release pretty much every November of .NET Core. And in terms of Visual Studio ships about 4 times a year. And what we do is basically as soon as possible, like after we've RTM'd the new version of .NET, we immediately start working on the next one. And we try to very much get our features into Visual Studio as fast as possible to preview them for the next version of .NET. So we're shipping all the time. And I remember it's so funny, like because I have a lot of people who report to me who are fairly new. And I remember one of them getting like very upset, like, oh, you know, if my feature doesn't make it here, it's going to be like 1 year before customers see it. I'm like, no, it's going to be like 3 months. Like you get to ship yours in preview in a few weeks. Like the next week, I used to have to wait like 5 years when I missed my ship window. It's like the context of like different eras. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure if you went back to like old days of working on operating systems, like, you know, the release cycles are like massive, massive. It's a whole other world. You mentioned this, like having this kind of like 6 month window where you might be able to make whatever changes mm-hmm. that you want. Is there an example of a feature or choice that was made that turned out it was like the wrong choice, like a mistake that you had to actually come back on?
I'm trying to think. I mean, we have these all the time. They're usually kind of in more of a side channel that impacts very little people. I mean, I'll give you a good example. Like we just released collection expressions, which is a feature in C# and .NET 8. And it's basically a syntax that serves two very good purposes for C#. One, it is a very concise syntax for creating collections. Like someone who is more familiar with Python would be very happy with this type of syntax. It's very minimalistic for creating these types. It's also one of the things we designed into it is the way those collections are created is we do it in the most efficient way possible. Like we will do all kinds of memory tricks. We will use the fastest runtime APIs we can take advantage of. And we've designed the feature such that as the runtime gets cool new ways of creating collections, we're free to just keep moving forward and making them faster and faster and faster. We realized after shipping, we had a number of features we knew would build on top of that in .NET 9. Like we're doing this thing called params span of T. And as we started getting into that work in C# 9, we realized we made a few decisions we kind of regretted in there. For one, we regretted that we look for things like when we're deciding how to build one of these collections, we have these things called builder types that we look to build them. And decisions like, can the add method on the builder be an extension method or not? We decided that was a bad decision. That was causing a lot of complexity in the compiler. There's a couple other esoteric decisions around how we treat the builders, where we look for them and what the relationships are. We basically decided after getting some customer feedback, starting to build new features on top of them and getting some bug reports that were like, those weren't the right decisions. And we need to kind of go in the other direction with that. And we've spent like about a month or two after shipping, resolving what the best way to address those problems were. And those changes will come out in about 17.10. They'll actually start shipping in preview in a couple of weeks from now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then how much does like what's normal or expected in a particular era of like programming languages like impact decisions that you make about language design? Like, you know, 20 years ago, a lot of languages used a lot of braces, lots of using statements, for example. And then as different types of applications have been built, there's all like a focus on sort of minimal languages now with Python and Go and so forth. And most programmers are building for the web today, not the desktop, which I think also probably influences the style of the languages that were used. Like, how much does that kind of impact the decisions in the different eras of C#?
It very much impacts them. You almost have like the perfect setup for like this answer too, which is great. We actually look at other languages and ecosystems a lot. Languages are, you know, a competitive space. I mean, I think that I say that in like a fun, happy way, but it's like, we absolutely like look at other languages and ecosystems and say like, do new programmers have a better time going to that language or they have a better time coming to our language? And we do absolutely look at things like that. And a great example was .NET 7, where at the kind of start of .NET 7, if you took kind of a Hello World web application, just a standard, like put up a web page, basic thing. And what we did was we basically said, let's put Node, Go, and .NET side by side. and let's look at them from the standpoint of someone who wants to start programming, who wants to find out what language and framework am I investing in. And we were not nearly as good. Node and Go were like so much better than us in terms of minimalistic style, having like a single file, having like a lack of ceremony associated with them. And we made a very deliberate effort across both the .NET runtime, the ASP.NET surface area, and the C-sharp language to say, we need to be in a better competitive space there. We want to be attractive to new programmers. And we took an entire release of the language. We made invasive changes to, like I mentioned, overload resolution, how lambdas work, which are very scary things for us because those are people get very deeply ingrained in how those things work in ways that they don't understand. They're relying on all these subtle rules that we're about to change. And the ASP.NET team changed a lot of their API surface area to be more flexible with this kind of minimalistic API approach. And we actually called it minimal APIs, or minimum APIs. I forget the name sometimes. But it very much was a big theme for .NET 7 to get us over that hump and put us in a better competitive space. And that was, like I said, a very big theme of it. And then even since then, we found all these little follow-up things to say, like, hey, we kind of missed this area. We can make this area better. And we just keep pushing and pushing on that.
How do you balance staying relevant and also attracting new developers to the language while not sort of like pissing off the base of people that have been using the language for years?
It can be tough. One thing we tell people, we do actually get a lot of feedback sometimes of like, hey, you invented a new way of doing things. One of the pushbacks we get is like, there's three different ways for checking for null now. And we always tell people, it's like, that's the cost of innovation. It's like, we very much made decisions to put pattern matching into the language because we felt it was such a powerful tool in the web space for dealing with requests and dealing with data. But it does, as a side effect, mean that you introduce like new ways to do comparisons. And if you want to have a slightly different way of checking for null, like you could do it. And we do get pushback on that. Customers are like, ah, you're making the language more confusing. You're making it harder. And our feedback to them is like, you don't have to move forward. C-sharp will keep compiling your old code and your old patterns forever. If you don't want to take the journey with us, like there's nothing stopping you from using the patterns and tools that are familiar to you. We're not breaking them. But we are telling people, if you want to embrace like the new way of doing things, this is how we move forward. And often some of the carrots are like better code generation, better support, you know, better integration with some of our tooling. But it is a balance and we do our best to kind of strike it. We're somewhat successful in it, I would say.
Has like the growth and adoption of something like JSON on the web influenced decisions that you made around the language? One of the reasons I think, you know, JavaScript and frameworks like Node caught on is there's just such a simple mapping between, I think, like JSON and the language is just like a direct mapping as the object structure. But in languages that are type-based and have more complex object structures, it's a bigger lift, essentially. You end up like parsing the JSON using a parsing library and then kind of trying to map that back into a data structure or something, and it's harder to work with.
It's definitely influenced us. There have been even pushes over the years to integrate those types. Like if you look at like Visual Basic, Visual Basic added XML literals into their code back in 2005, I believe. Very much trying to remove that like lift and shift. It's like, nope, the XML is right here and you can do exactly what you want to it. We have a structured API around it. We've gotten pressures to do things like that in C#. And thus far, we've kind of like resisted them on the idea we don't want to be tied to a data format that might, you know, if the web shifts to a new format, like that would kind of obsolete that work in our language. Instead, what we do is we work really closely with the people who are writing these JSON serializers, who are writing the APIs that do that mapping between JSON and .NET objects, and ensuring that we have the features in place so that they can be successful. Like I mentioned source generation earlier about we have the ability to generate source at compile time. We worked very closely with the system text JSON team so that they had enough flexibility in their generators to have very efficient mappings for parsing JSON into C#, minimal allocations, high perf, things like that. But in terms of the actual putting JSON into the language, it's much more working with teams who are doing that to do what we can to make them successful.
What are some of the hard problems in compiler design? Is it like overload resolution, I would think would be something difficult?
I often tell people it's like overload resolution is easy. Implicit conversions are easy. If you have a language with both, it's hard mode. It's basically impossible mode. If you have implicit conversions and overload resolution, it just becomes impossible mode. That is definitely one of the harder problems. Like C# is very much a language that has implicit conversions and overload resolution and type inference. And that is a very devilish problem, particularly the way we kind of historically have inherited a few of those things. We spend an enormous amount of our time when we design new features and want them to be very fluid. We have to consider, how does it impact overload resolution? How does that change type inference? One of the jokes I have in the team is our normal review rules for the compiler is two compiler devs have to sign off on every change that touches the compiler. If you touch overload resolution, all the devs have to sign off, all the principals, because like it's in a very gnarly space. But outside of that, I would think one of the hard problems is just like the aesthetics of the language. I've been the compiler lead for 7 years now. I've worked on the compiler teams for probably the last 15 years. And I often tell people, it's like, I know how to make compiler. I know how to educate people on becoming a compiler dev. We're very good at taking junior devs, introducing them our code base, teaching them how to be a compiler engineer. Like that's it's an engineering problem. We're very good at teaching people the engineering skills. People are like, how do you become a good language designer? And my answer is like, you sit in the room for like 3 or 4 years and watch people do it, and hopefully you can become good too. Like it's such an aesthetic thing. And getting the aesthetics of the language right, it's an art. And it's very hard, and there are not that many people who are very good at it. Even myself, I've been here 20 years, I've done most of my work there. I submit a lot of designs that go into the C# language, particularly in kind of our performance areas. But even me, like I understand that my skills do not include like pure aesthetics of the language. And I often joke, I will submit some designs sometimes. Well, the aesthetics will be deliberately terrible. And they're like, why'd you do that? I'm like, we all know we're not picking my aesthetics. It's like, what I've done here is define the rules for this thing and kind of a shape for what the feature will look like. You guys are eventually going to pick the shape. Like, mm-hmm. I'm just here to like help you understand what the rules need to be. And then there's a couple shapes that'll be fine by me. So it's like understanding that. But it's definitely like, there's such an aesthetic to that. And it's, some people have a very natural gift for it. Some people can be taught, but it is definitely something that it's much more of an art sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like probably any form of design. Like if you're designing graphics, you can learn how to use a graphics tool. You can take a course and you'll probably be better and more competent than maybe I would be. But I think the art side of it, the aesthetic piece, I don't know how you necessarily get there, like whether it's like an innate thing or, you know, some training that probably happens outside of engineering anyway.
Yeah. Like I've gotten to a point now, I'm very comfortable saying, I think that's a bad aesthetic for the language. But when I'm like, I'm not sure if that's good or like, good, is that great? We'll let other people decide. Mm-hmm.
And then how has the move to like open source impacted what you do?
Oh, enormously on so many different levels. I mean, you have like even kind of like there's like the base engineering problems. When we went open source on GitHub, initially like CodePlex, but GitHub was really the place we became like an open source tool. It's like you're shifting a culture that has been non-open source for its entire life, getting that engineering system, just building in GitHub, building in the open without machines is in itself a huge challenge. I mean, Roslyn, when we started that compiler, there was a lot of thought that by the time we finished that, Microsoft would be in a place that was more amenable to having open source projects. And so they tried to develop with the, we're eventually going to open source this in mind. But even then, like I was a part of the engineering team that took us to GitHub, months and months of work to just undo things. Like your build system has all these subtle dependencies on internal systems, ripping those out, finding code which is not open source friendly that you have to get out of your system. It's like, nope, can't ship that library. That's not an open source friendly library. We have to lift and shift over to here. Just your build systems, like moving from a place where you have these beautiful internal build systems that can talk to all these services to say, hey, we're on GitHub now. We can't talk to any of that. Like this is all building in the open. We have to now find replacements for all of these tools, these libraries, these services. It was an enormous engineering shift. And I would say even probably we didn't really figure out the engineering shift for like a couple of years until we got good at building out in the open and getting our dealing with these dual builds where we build in the open, but we also build internally for shipping purposes.
Has it made the product better?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things we take a lot of pride in now is like, you can just go to our repo, clone and build. Clone, build, F5. Like I tell people, it's like, and listen, Roslyn, open a Visual Studio, hit F5, a new version of Visual Studio will pop up with a C# compiler and you can just start playing and having fun. There was zero chance that would have been true before we went open source. Like when you joined the team at Microsoft, the first thing you did, the first commit you make in a new team repository at Microsoft is you find the README file on how to build the code. Like, what services you list to, what security groups you got to be in, and then you find the errors in it from what has changed since the last person joined the team, and you send the commit. You send the commit to say, here's the new way to like build our repo. And that type of system works when you're working with like 10 people who can like come sit at your desk and be like, oh yeah, we forgot that you joined this group. Now, that does not scale to open source. Open source, you have to make it, if you want contributions and you want people to participate, the entry point to building and running your code has to be as small as possible. And so we very deliberately went to the open, put a lot of emphasis on how do we make this easy? How do we make it the simplest possible? Clone, open Visual Studio, go. And so it is definitely a better product in terms of that respect.
Yeah, it becomes a forcing function probably for actually writing good documentation too, because you can't just tap your buddy on the on the shoulder and ask the question.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I remember when we first, for a while, we went open source, people would start saying these PRs to Ross. I'm like, I have this new language feature and I want to merge it. We're like, stop, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this? And we're like, this is not how you do a language feature. Like, you have to go to like the language design committee, get it approved. You can't do a feature in a PR. It's way too big. We have to do the IDE. We have to do ENC. Like, this, stop. And they're like, well, you never told us. And it's just like this knowledge we had in our head of like, you can't do that. And we're like, you know, we're right. We've never told people like how to do this. And so we actually sat down and put like a document out like, hey, you want to submit a language feature? Here's the process. Like, this is what we do. And please also don't start with this. Please send some bug fixes so we know who you are, that you're worth. Because one thing we had to really communicate to people, it's like, there's no such thing as a free PR. Like, we have to review your PR. We have to maintain the code. There's an enormous resource investment on our part to even get your language feature in. And so we don't want to commit to doing that to just someone who says they have a good idea. Like, we want to see people who have done bug fixes, maybe some refactorings that we'd like, okay, you're going to be here for the long haul. You've displayed a minimum amount of competence here. We feel like investing in you is not as big of a risk. We feel like it's probably going to pay off now.
Mm-hmm. So you've been working on C Sharp for 20 years at Microsoft, as we said at the head of the show. So what keeps you like interested and engaged?
I don't know. So I tell people that like I've worked here for 20 years, but I've had about five different jobs. I originally started in a different part of Visual Studio. Then I kind of moved to, I actually started in the Visual Basic team. I worked on the compiler for a while, then I worked in the debugger. Then I went and worked in research for a little while on kind of like systems, taking C Sharp in a systems level direction, doing permissions, async await, a bunch of other things. And then coming back, I came back to the .NET team about 7 or 8 years ago and took over the C Sharp compiler lead. And so I've had a number of different roles over the years. And I think the thing that keeps me interested is like, there are just so many different problems to solve. Like, yes, my main job is usually the C Sharp compiler lead, but I also do things like I help out with our infrastructure because we have an enormous infrastructure for .NET. The scale of testing we have, the scale of our builds problems, our security challenges, and we're always constantly changing what we're working on. Like, we used to be a couple of years ago, it was like Office programming. Then we're having to like learn about that to help solve those problems. We have to learn about ML for a while to help solve some ML problems. And we had a big performance push, which helped me learn a lot about like how performance work, what matters, how can I help these guys with C Sharp so that they can write better performant code. And now we're starting to learn about things like AI. So one of the nice parts we're talking about in like the language space is I get introduced to all these different problems and I can get these little tidbits of fun that I can pull into my day, learn a little bit, and kind of move on and get the next little tidbit. And also, the .NET team is just fun. I often joke with people, it's like people come to DevDiv, but they don't leave. Because DevDiv, we have fun problems. We have a really good culture. And a lot of like my out-of-work friends I met at Microsoft on our teams. And we had enough fun working together that we started hanging out afterwards too. And so it's just a really fun team to be on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would think for like working on a language that's been around for this long and been relevant as well. It's like, it's evolving as the industry evolves as too. Like some of these things that we've talked to, like different eras that align with like what is relevant in the industry at any given point. And that's changing all the time as well. So there's always like new problems to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely part of the appeal to it, is it is always changing. The environment around us is always changing. And so it's not the same old job every day. It's like a new facet to your job, like every year or so.
Awesome. So as we start to wrap up, you know, what's next for C Sharp? And is there anything else you'd like to share?
What's next for C Sharp is like, I think we're kind of looking forward to .NET 9 upcoming. So we've got a number of performance features we're working on. A big area of performance for C Sharp is what we call like ref structs and span of T. That's kind of our basic performance primitives. And in this release, we have a number of features where we have been establishing the building blocks for these features over the last few releases. And so in this upcoming release, we're probably getting param span of T, which will give us a zero alloc overhead variable argument calling format in C#, which is really exciting. And we're also changing language so that we're likely changing language so we can start passing these ref structs as generic arguments and have them implement interfaces and make them a lot easier to program with in kind of our lower level parts of the framework. And on the productivity side of C#, we have this project we've been incubating for a couple of years now. It's called either Shapes or Roles, depending on when you've started paying attention to it, but will be likely released under the moniker of implicit and explicit extensions. And like I said, this has been in incubation for about 2 years now, and we're likely going to be shipping the first kind of slice of that puzzle in .NET 9. And so I'm really excited about kind of that work upcoming.
Awesome. Well, Jared, thanks so much for being here. You've had such an interesting insight into the history of everything that's happened with C# in there almost from the beginning. I feel like I could, you know, talk for another hour on this. So, but I want to thank you so much for taking time and being here. So cheers.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a great time.